Chapter 13. The Ross Sea Party. I now turn to the fortunes and misfortunes of the Ross Sea Party and the Aurora. In spite of extraordinary difficulties occasioned by the breaking out of the Aurora from her winter quarters before sufficient stores and equipment had been landed, Captain Aeneas McIntosh and the party under his command achieved the object of this side of the expedition. For the depot that was the main object of the expedition was laid in the spot that I had indicated, and if the transcontinental party had been fortunate enough to have crossed, they would have found the assistance, in the shape of stores, that would have been vital to the success of their undertaking. Owing to the dearth of stores, clothing, and sledging equipment, the depot party was forced to travel more slowly and with greater difficulty than would have otherwise been the case. The result was that in making this journey, the greatest qualities of endurance, self-sacrifice, and patience were called for. And the call was not in vain, as you, reading the following pages, will realize. It is more than regrettable that after having gone through those many months of hardship and toil, McIntosh and Heywood should have been lost. Spencer Smith, during those long days dragged by his comrades on the sledge, suffering but never complaining, became an example to all men. McIntosh and Heywood owed their lives on that journey to the unremitting care and strenuous endeavours of Joyce, Wild, and Richards, who, also scurvy-stricken but fitter than their comrades, dragged them through the deep snow and blizzards on the sledges. I think that no more remarkable story of human endeavour has been revealed than the tale of that long march, which I have collated from various diaries. Unfortunately, the diary of the leader of this side of the expedition was lost with him. The outstanding feature of the Ross Sea side was the journey made by these six men. The earlier journeys for the first year did not produce any sign of the qualities of leadership amongst the others. McIntosh was fortunate for the long journey in that he had these three men with him, Ernest Wild, Richards, and Joyce. Before proceeding with the adventures of this party, I want to make clear in these pages how much I appreciate the assistance I received both in Australia and New Zealand, especially in the latter dominion. And amongst the many friends there, it is not invidious on my part to lay special stress on the name of Leonard Tripp, who has been my mentor, counsellor, and friend for many years, and who, when the expedition was in precarious and difficult circumstances, devoted his energy, thought, and gave his whole time and advice to the best interests of our cause. I must also thank Edward Saunders, who for the second time has greatly helped me in preparing an expedition record for publication. To the Dominion Government I tender my warmest thanks. To the people of New Zealand, and especially to those many friends, too numerous to mention here, who helped us when our fortunes were at a low ebb, I wish to say that their kindness is an evergreen memory to me. If ever a man had cause to be grateful for assistance in dark days, I am he. The Aurora, under the command of Captain Aeneas McIntosh, sailed from Hobart for the Ross Sea on December 24, 1914. The ship had been refitted in Sydney, where the state and federal governments had given generous assistance, and would be able, if necessary, to spend 2 years in the Antarctic. My instructions to Captain McIntosh, in brief, were to proceed to the Ross Sea, make a base at some convenient point in or near McMurdo Sound, land stores and equipment, and lay depots on the Great Ice Barrier in the direction of the Beardmore Glacier for the use of the party that I expected to bring overland from the Weddell Sea coast. This program would involve some heavy sledging, but the ground to be covered was familiar, and I had not anticipated that the work would present any great difficulties. The Aurora carried materials for a hut, full equipment for landing and sledging parties, stores and clothing of all the kinds required, and an ample supply of sledges. There were also dog teams and one of the motor tractors. I had told Captain McIntosh that it was possible the transcontinental journey would be attempted in the 1914-15 season, in the event of the landing on the Weddell Sea coast proving unexpectedly easy, and it would be his duty, therefore, to lay out depots to the south immediately after his arrival at his base. I had directed him to place a depot of food and fuel oil at latitude 80 degrees south in 1914-15, with cairns and flags as guide to a sledging party approaching from the direction of the pole. He would place depots further south in the 1915-16 season. The Aurora had an uneventful voyage southwards. She anchored off the sealing huts at Macquarie Island on Christmas Day, December 25th. The wireless station erected by Sir Douglas Mawson's Australian Antarctic expedition could be seen on a hill to the northwest, with the expedition's hut at the base of the hill. This hut was still occupied by our meteorological staff, and later in the day the meteorologist, Mr. Tulloch, came off to the ship and had dinner aboard. The Aurora had some stores for the Macquarie Island party, and these were sent ashore during succeeding days in the boats. The landing place was a rough, kelp-guarded beach where lay the remains of the New Zealand bark Clyde. Macquarie Island anchorages are treacherous, and several ships engaged in the sealing and whaling trade have left their bones on the rocky shores, where bask great herds of seals and sea elephants. The Aurora sailed from the island on December 31st, and 3 days later they sighted the first iceberg, a tabular berg rising 250 feet above the sea. This was in latitude 62 degrees 40 minutes south, longitude 169 degrees 58 minutes east. The next day, in latitude 64 degrees 27 minutes 38 seconds south, the Aurora passed through the first belt of pack ice. At 9 a.m. on January 7th, Mount Sabine, a mighty peak of the Admiralty Range, South Victoria Land, was sighted 75 miles distant. It had been proposed that a party of three men should travel to Cape Crozier from winter quarters during the winter months in order to secure emperor penguins' eggs. The ship was to call at Cape Crozier, land provisions, and erect a small hut of fibro-concrete sheets for the use of this party. The ship was off the Cape on the afternoon of January 9th, and a boat put off with Stenhouse, Cope, Joyce, Ninnis, Morgar, and Aitken to search for a landing place. "We steered in towards the barrier," wrote Stenhouse, "and found an opening leading into a large bight which jutted back to eastward into the barrier. We endeavoured without success to scale the steep ice foot under the cliffs and then proceeded up the bay. Pulling along the edge of perpendicular ice, we turned into a bay in the ice cliff and came to a cul-de-sac, at the head of which was a grotto. At the head of the grotto and on a ledge of snow were perched some Adélie penguins. The beautiful green and blue tints in the ice colouring made a picture as unreal as a stage setting. Coming back along the edge of the bight towards the land, we caught and killed one penguin, much to the surprise of another, which ducked into a niche in the ice and, after much squawking, was extracted with a boat hook and captured. We returned to our original landing, and were fortunate in our time, for no sooner had we cleared the ledge where Ninnis had been hanging in his endeavour to catch the penguin than the barrier calved, and a piece weighing hundreds of tons toppled over into the sea. Since we left the ship, a mist had blown up from the south, and when we arrived back at the entrance to the bay, the ship could be but dimly seen. We found a slope on the ice foot, and Joyce and I managed, by cutting steps, to climb up to a ledge of debris between the cliffs and the ice, which we thought might lead to the vicinity of the Emperor Penguin Rookery. I sent the boat back to the ship to tell the captain of our failure to find a spot where we could depot the hut and stores, and then, with Joyce, set out to walk along the narrow land between the cliffs and the ice to the southward in hopes of finding the rookery. We walked for about a mile along the foot of the cliffs, over undulating paths, sometimes crawling carefully down a gully, and then over rocks and debris which had fallen from the steep cliffs which towered above us, but we saw no signs of a rookery or any place where a rookery could be. Close to the cliffs and separated from them by the path on which we travelled, the barrier, in its movement towards the sea, had broken and showed signs of pressure. Seeing a turn in the cliffs ahead, which we thought might lead to better prospects, we trudged on, and were rewarded by a sight which Joyce admitted as being the grandest he had ever witnessed. The barrier had come into contact with the cliffs, and, from where we viewed it, it looked as if icebergs had fallen into a tremendous cavern and lay jumbled together in wild disorder. Looking down into that wonderful picture, one realized a little the eternalness of things. We had not long to wait, and, much as we wished to go ahead, had to turn back. I went into a small crevasse, no damage. Arriving back at the place where we left the boat, we found it had not returned, so sat down under an overhang and smoked and enjoyed the sense of loneliness. Soon the boat appeared out of the mist, and the crew had much news for us. After we left the ship, the captain manoeuvred her in order to get close to the barrier, but, unfortunately, the engines were loath to be reversed when required to go astern, and the ship hit the barrier end-on. The barrier here is about 20 feet high, and her jib-boom took the weight and snapped at the cap. When I returned, Thompson was busy getting the broken boom and gear aboard.